Hey, Anna, I know it's your favorite season is coming up. We got Halloween coming up. Are you excited?
Oh yeah, I'm totally basic. I love Halloween, love fall. Yeah, I cannot wait. I love being scared in the moment.
Really?
Then I regret it. Then I'm like, oh, why did I read all that or watch that scary movie? But yes, I'm excited.
Well, we got some scary stories in the stars right now. This is the time of year where some of the fall constellations come up that some of them involve some pretty weird and strange stories. And there's one that's associated with the Day of the Dead, and that is the Seven Sisters star cluster, the Pleiades.
Oh,
This is
that's
like
nice, the
the
Pleiades.
biggest, brightest star cluster up in the sky that comes up every fall. But it does have a kind of gross association.
Really?
Yes. Like when we're talking about the old days back in the Yucatan Peninsula and the Mayan Empire, well, from where they are, the Seven Sisters can go straight overhead. And when the Seven Sisters were straight over top of one of the pyramids, that signaled the time for human sacrifices to happen. And it usually happened right around October 31st. That is the day or the night where the Seven Sisters are highest up in the sky at midnight.
That's actually really creepy.
I know it is. But you can see the Seven Sisters and not be too scared
And
now,
it's
right?
fine. No one's gonna come and sacrifice you.
No, we've come a long way since then. But it signals the start of our spooky season. Are you scared?
I'm petrified. Happy not to be an ancient Mayan, but yes, still creeped out by that history because I like the Pleiades. They're like, it's a cute name, Seven Sisters, but nope.
Nope. That's right.
You're
Head cutting
dead.
off. Not good.
That's right. It's over. Oh gosh, now I'm all spooked out. Okay. Ugh,
See, I thought you, well, see, you just like you said, you regret it.
I know. Why did I even ask you about this? Ugh.
Oh boy, wait till you hear the next one. From the various home studios and Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Anna Heeman. We are both from the Cincinnati Observatory, where Dean is the astronomer and I'm the grounded one. In this episode, we'll be talking dark matter, COVID-19, and more with science writer and astrophysicist Ethan Siegel. So, it's Halloween time almost. I'm super excited. I am creeped out. Why is everything so like dark? Not like dark physics. Like, why is it like? There's a lot of like some dark roots to some of the stuff in astronomy.
I know. Well, you got to make up some good stories. That's the thing. I mean, it's just like today we have all these great scary movies, and it's just like people. That's one of the cool things is that this connection that we've had to these stories. People have been liking to be scared for a long time, I think. I think that's part of the deal.
But it's so beautiful. The sky is so beautiful with the stars in it. And then you have these like, because I just went to Cumberland and it was like dark sky and it was so pretty with the stars. I wasn't thinking about people getting sacrificed over a temple.
Well, yeah, I mean, you were telling me about your trip to Lake Cumberland, and yeah, well, I mean, what was that like to step outside and see that sky?
Oh, it was a really, I felt kind of dumb. Like, how did you not realize that the world, you know, it has this beauty in it? Because I was like, as I think I had mentioned, you know, I was sort of, we'd had a long drive, we're in the middle of nowhere, speaking of scary, and it just happened to be, you know, get all our stuff out of the car, and you know, I just look up and it was like just so incredibly beautiful. It was like black sky, sort of purplish almost, it felt like, and these stars were so bright, and it was really kind of a moment, actually. But I'm usually not in dark sky. You know, I live, you know, in a city. This is like, we were literally in the middle of nowhere, and it was just really gorgeous.
I know, isn't that amazing? I'm so glad you had that.
Yes.
I mean, that's like something I miss having living in the city. You don't get to see the sky how it's supposed to be, and
Yeah.
it is pretty startling. And for me, it's a little scary because it's so dark, and there's so many stars. And I mean, trust me, even I feel that when I see all those stars, I'm like, whoa, I don't know which ones those. I mean, you can't even make out some of the constellations anymore because they're so more in depth. And so I don't know, did it inspire you to, did you see any shapes up in the sky? Did you see any scary or non-scary constellations up there?
The only thing that was scary was not being able to get cell service, but scary in the sense of the sky. It was really just, I don't know, I guess this is like a little cheesy, but it was like, it literally, like, I was in the middle of something completely different. I was just like dumbstruck. It was like, I saw some like more sparkly ones that seemed like some bigger ones. And it was just, because I always think when we are at the observatory or whatever, I'm like, the sky looks nice here. It looks pretty. It's not polluted or whatever. But when you're really around nothing else, it is just like, and I was trying to find some constellations and things. I can find like the Big Dipper, like that, or Orion. I can also find Orion. Those are the two that I could find, which again, they look like nothing. So it's not my fault. But anyway, it was just a lovely moment. I was like, wow, we are really able, we are part of a really beautiful planet.
Oh, that's so cool that you got to see that. Yeah, I can't wait to do some stargazing on getting out away from the city a little bit. And and it, you know, when you sit back there and you look up there, and I do try to picture the sky like the ancients did. I try to like kick back and say, okay, so where did they see all these pictures? And boy, I cannot do it. Like, I don't have that much imagination or something. I don't know what's going on, but fall is the time for one of the constellation families that are in the sky. These are like a group of groups of constellations that come together that are associated into one gigantic story. And it's supposed to be scary. I don't know how well I can tell it. I don't think I'll scare you too much. Not like the Pleiades sacrifice story, but
that was like,
yeah, well, you know, I got to get your attention with that one. But but the story that I always think about with fall is I call it the Fall Star Saga, because it involves a lot of different constellations. It involves a king, a queen, a princess, a prince, two monsters, and a flying horse, all up there in the sky. And so should I spin the tale?
I think I know which one it is. Maybe not. Guess. Tell me.
Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, there was a prince, and his name was Perseus. And Perseus was the adopted son of a king. And so when he grew up to age, he decided to be a professional monster hunter. And for his first hunt, he went after Medusa.
I'm sorry, it's a professional monster hunter.
Go ahead. You know, that was
a very grown-up job.
There were only a couple different jobs in the ancient world.
You know, that's right.
You had accountants, you had
human sacrifice
and professional monster hunter. He decided that was the best of the jobs that was available to him. And so he was favored by the gods and got a sword that could cut through anything, a shield shiny as a mirror, and winged sandals to fly through the air with the greatest of ease. So for his first monster, who do you think he would go after? I threw you for a loop on that one, didn't I?
I know. I like want to make a joke, but I'm not going to make it a modern day joke.
Think of a woman with snakes for hair.
I'm going to go. I think it must be Medusa.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. So he went after Medusa.
Who is just misunderstood. Like, stop looking at her. It's not that hard.
Yeah. I mean,
leave her alone.
I don't know. I mean, so she has snakes for hair. What's the big deal? But yeah, right. If you look at her, you turn to stone, and that's the problem.
That is a problem.
And I mean, people just kept coming to try to look at her. It's their own fault. I mean, they should know. Yeah.
You heard the story. Nobody comes back. So.
So anyway, Perseus decides to go after her. And so he goes to the cave of Medusa, sets up his shield in the sand to act like a mirror. And then he can see Medusa's reflection safely. And so he he set that up and saw her coming, took out his sword and closed his eyes and chopped her head right off. And so picked up her head to carry it around to take it home for him, because he didn't just want to leave like Medusa's head laying around on the ground, because
she was just minding her business. But okay, Perseus, you're a hero, quote unquote.
I understand. I think this is a little much too, but you know, when you're a professional monster hunter, you got to make work for yourself, I guess.
You got to produce.
Yeah. So in a nearby kingdom, another a queen there, her name is Cassiopeia, got into a little bit of trouble because she was bragging about her beauty. And she bragged too much. She said that she was more beautiful than all the mermaids in the ocean. And I don't know. I don't think you should be saying that, because
that's a mistake.
That is a mistake, because the god of the sea, Poseidon, heard about this and came to punish them. And to punish Cassiopeia for vanity, Poseidon came and confronted the king and queen and said, "You must sacrifice your one and only daughter Andromeda to the sea monster. Chain her to a rock."
She is innocent. She didn't do anything.
This is the it's not fair. It's not fair. So they had to chain Andromeda to a rock in the ocean and let the sea monster eat her. Well, as this is happening, Perseus is flying back home with his wing sandals and sees down below that Andromeda is chained to a rock and sees the sea monster coming out of the briny deep about to eat her, and yells down, "Close your eyes, Andromeda." And he reaches into the bag, pulls out Medusa's bloody head, shows it to the sea monster, who sees it, cracks or turns to stone, cracks and falls into the bottom of the ocean, never to be seen again. And Perseus races down and unchains Andromeda, and they fly away to live happily ever after. So,
your typical love story. Typical. How'd you guys meet? Oh, God. You know, that old chestnut where you're tied to a rock because your dad or your mom was talking to them, and then the gods got upset. He was flying by on his wing shoes, got me off the rock. Now we're hanging out, and it's going great.
I mean,
better than Tinder.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you could have stopped. I knew where that was going at the end of that. I mean, I was like, yeah, I've heard that one before.
That's right. Like, oh, I've heard that 1,000 times.
So that's, you can see all these constellations up in the sky. The king is Cepheus, who's shaped kind of like a upside down house.
Okay.
We got Cassiopeia, shaped like a W. We got Perseus that's shaped like the letter K. And we have Andromeda, shaped like the letter A. And Perseus is holding out Medusa's head in the stars, a star named Algol, that dims its light every two and a half days. And so it was thought to be a very evil star because it changed its brightness. So, and then there's the sea monster constellation, Cetus, over to the side. But for fans of these Greek myths, there is one character that I'm missing. I got the king, the queen, prince, princess, monsters. I'm missing the flying horse. And so you've seen those old movies, the Clash of the Titans movies, where Pegasus is involved in the scene. Well, the real story, according to the ancient Greeks, as in the real made up myth, is really gross. I don't know. Can you handle this? This is really gross, where Pegasus comes from.
Okay. Whatever.
So in the battle, while Perseus is holding out Medusa's bloody head, showing to the sea monster, some blood fell out of her neck and fell into the seawater. And somehow, some way, through some kind of jello-like process, the blood and seawater came together to form into Pegasus the Flying Horse.
This is a children's program, Dean.
This is a classic.
You're just telling isn't
there's,
it?
There's no, it's good for all ages, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is really quality, very quality, very kid-friendly discussion topic.
I was allowed to read that story as a very youngster, but
actually, I was too. That was my favorite book. Was this giant book of Greek myths, and I was young reading that thing, and it was dark. There was some like Hera's turning people into spiders, and all this, and then they got this, the big sea monster, and then you've got. I mean, my goodness, yeah.
I apologize to all the parents out there. I'm sorry. We should have put a warning on this. This is classic Greek mythology story.
That's right.
Appropriate for only, I don't know.
Greek mythology enthusiasts.
Exactly.
No, I love it. I didn't realize that Pegasus was formed out of some bloody seawater. Good.
Isn't
for
that
him.
Weird? I know. Like something beautiful came out of this.
Yeah, that's nice.
I guess that part's nice. It's just kind of gross. And you also just like are thinking, what in the world are they talking about when they're doing this stuff? I mean, they really came up some wild stories, that's for sure.
Yeah, I don't think today we could recreate them.
I don't think so. I don't know if we can even compete with these Greek myths, but so anyway, well, hopefully that doesn't scare anybody out there, but you can find a lot of these constellations up in the sky, and I don't know, see if you can see Medusa's head up there. I sure can't. Dr. Ethan Siegel is a theoretical astrophysicist and a writer who studies the Big Bang Theory. He writes the Starts with a Bang blog, and his work also appears on Forbes.com. We're really looking forward to touching on a few different topics with him today. So thanks for joining us today, Ethan.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure to be here. It's my pleasure to be on your show, and thank you for inviting me.
So one of the little drawbacks of doing a podcast is that the visitors here can't exactly see you. And, you know, when folks look you up on the internet, they will find a very unique scientist. I mean, they don't, when you think of scientists, you have certain things in mind. And I got to say, you definitely have the most unique approach to science. And what I tell us a little bit about kind of how you got into this field and your unique way of being a science communicator.
I mean, so, you know, my story, like everyone else's, it's unique, right? You have your own story about who you are, where you came from, how you grew up, and what you wanted to be. So when I talk about me and who I am, I talk about like, okay, like I went to college and I majored in a few different things because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And my first job out of college, I actually became a public high school teacher. I became a public school teacher. I don't think a lot of people know that about me, but that's what I went and did. And it was while I was doing that, that I sort of said, okay, well, now it's time to have a crisis. I think a lot of people, they look at the world and they see crisis as a dirty word. And I don't think it is. I think it is one of those transformative moments in your life where you say, I'm going down this path. There are things I like about it, but things I need to change. And if this isn't working for me overall, what do I do next? And to me, as a teacher, I was saying, well, okay, I'm out there teaching people things, but what do I want to know for myself, right? There are certain things where I'm thinking like, geez, if I could just know this about the universe, if I could know this, my whole life would be richer. And there were, for me, there were these big existential questions that I wanted to answer, questions like, what is the universe? Where did it come from? How did it grow up to be this way? And what is its ultimate fate? And I was so stoked to learn, you know, hey, this is not something that you go to philosophy school or theology school to learn the answers. These are scientific questions, and we can answer them scientifically. And there's a whole field that does it. It's called theoretical cosmology. It's a branch of theoretical astrophysics, and this is where we investigate that. So I did my research. I applied to graduate schools. I got in. And so I've always had these sort of dual passions of teaching and of learning about the cutting edge science and researching into it. And so, you know, after doing that, becoming a scientist, doing a postdoc, I was sort of thinking, you know, what do I want to do? Yeah, I could become a professor. I could, you know, go into research or go into teaching, or I can start getting into outreach. I could start trying to teach, what do we know? How do we know it? With this expert level knowledge that I've gained, but I can try to do this to a broad general audience. And, you know, like most people, I didn't have the resources to say I'm going to do this full time right away. So I did become a professor, and I was that for many years. But I also just started writing, giving talks, communicating, and I do this exactly as myself. So when you see me, you're going to see a guy with a bald head, a big styled beard and mustache, wearing a kilt, and that's what I look like on a normal day. And not every day is a normal day because I get invited to things like parties and events at conventions like science fiction fantasy conventions. And so I dress up and I wear costumes. And if you go ahead and Google me, you will find lots of stories about the universe, lots of stuff about space, things I've written, and you will also find very non-standard costumes where I've dressed as everything from anime characters to Queen Elsa from Frozen to the James Webb Space Telescope to Zangief from Street Fighter 2 and all sorts of other varied bizarre costumes. So if you go and you look up Ethan Siegel on the internet and you look at, you know, my writings, my books, my podcasts, and, you know, images of me, I hope you think to yourself, you know what? this is every bit as much of what a scientist looks like as anyone else who's a scientist.
I love it. That's great. I think that's awesome. And we did have a good
time.
Yeah,
I mean, thanks. You know, I suppose you weren't expecting like, oh, like this first very simple question, let's get a 5-minute answer out of him from it. But, you know, I think that it's very important to let people know, you know, no matter who you are, what you're all about, what your path is, science is for you. Not everyone goes straight from high school to college to grad school to being a scientist. Not everyone knows what they want to do. It's perfectly normal and perfectly fine to take a few steps down a path, to recognize this is not the right path, and to step back a step or two and say, where do I go from here? That's a perfectly normal part of life, and I want to help normalize that for everyone. There's a lot of pressure that we put on ourselves to do everything perfectly the very first time we go to do it. And not only is that not how life works, that isn't even how science works. You have to go through a process of learning, trying things, revising, and trying new things until you hit upon that thing that's right, both in when it comes to the universe and science, and also when it comes to you and your own personal, how do I live a happy, satisfying life with myself?
Yeah, and can I do that maybe wearing a kilt or dressed as Elsa from Frozen, which I think is nice because Halloween is the greatest and you don't always get a chance to dress up. And if you can do it while doing what you really like, I think that's kind of excellent. So I think it's free.
Yeah, I was very fortunate in 2009 to start a professor job at Lewis and Clark College because they had absolutely no restrictions on what I would wear. And so I went from having a few kilts to being a person who only wears kilts because I did not have any professional things that were holding me back from doing so. And I'm very fortunate now as a self-employed science communicator that my boss is extremely lax about my dress code.
Well, speaking of science communication, can you tell us a little bit about your blog?
Yeah. My blog starts with a bang, and I started it in 2008 while I actually was a postdoc at the University of Arizona as a way of sort of telling these fabulous stories about the universe, about science, about what we know and how we know it to the general public. And I'm so pleased that this has grown in popularity, that people like hearing these stories, that they like getting this expert level knowledge, but they like getting it in plain English and with lots of illustrations and not with a lot of equations or any equations, that they like having this brought to them at an expert level, but broken down so that everyone can understand it. One of the great compliments that I've gotten is that there are professors all around the world who use what I write for two purposes. One is to give to their students to read, but they also use it personally for themselves to educate themselves about areas of physics and astronomy where they themselves aren't experts. And that to me is a very high compliment, that I can write something that resonates with the general public, but is even informative for professionals about what's going on in tangentially related fields. So that, I think, is really, that's a niche that I felt it was very important to fill, is to get that rigorous, good, hard science, you know, from an independent scientist, but also to get it broken down so that it's useful and accessible and it has these interesting bits for people of all different levels. That was sort of the goal that I was aiming for. And it's, you know, it's funny to think about it in these terms because I've been doing it for 12 years now, but it's the sort of thing where every day, every new story that I write, it is a new challenge to hit that sweet spot, to get it right, and to produce something that will resonate with everyone who comes to read it.
Yeah, the one that struck me recently and kind of that got me back on your blog Starts with a Bang was your article about what we don't know about dark matter. And I really appreciated that because most theoretical astrophysicists will not admit defeat that they don't know something about dark matter. Because, and I just so love to have that actual acknowledgement that you don't know that much about dark matter. I love to see that. Thanks so much for writing that one.
You know, I think this is really important. You know, we always ask, you know, as lay people in our lives, we always start asking questions about, okay, what do we know? And what do people think? And what's the evidence for it? And we ask these questions to go up to the limits of our knowledge. And that's an extremely important and valuable point to get to. But it's also, you know, going right up to that line, you can see all the things on the other side of that line. What don't we know? Because every single theory or framework or model that we have, it doesn't solve the entire universe. Nothing does. If we knew how to solve the entire universe, science would be a very different field than what it actually is. Instead, for every theory we have, for every framework we have, we say, okay, here's what's been established, and here's this range of circumstances, of conditions, of parameters where this idea seems to be valid, where this idea pays off, where here's what we know and how we know it, and it's been well established. And then you go outside of that range. And that's where things start getting very hazy, where you say, okay, if this theory is still good, or this idea is still good, or this is still the dominant effect or factor outside of this range, this is what the theory predicts will happen. But are there other effects that are coming in? Have we measured it? What do the measurements tell us, or what don't the measurements tell us, right? These are big, important questions that are just as important as the things we know. And this is one of those things I look at and I say, it's important to quantify and be honest about your ignorance and your uncertainty. Because when you aren't, when you don't consider what don't I know, what haven't I tested, what haven't I looked at, what lies outside of where I've tested, that's where you run into this big, big risky area where you can fool yourself, where you think you know how something must turn out, even though you haven't looked or tested it. There are all sorts of complaints I get from people who are like, ah, why are we still testing Einstein's theory of relativity? We know it's right. Ah, why are we still testing the standard model of particle physics? We know it's right. Ah, why do we, right? We have these known laws of physics and they're good everywhere we've looked. But if we want to say, what lies beyond them? Where do the laws of physics break down? Is there any new stuff out there to look at? We have to look in ways that we haven't looked before. And that's why we do it. It's not just because we want to confirm our theories or we hope to discover something new that refutes these theories. We want to understand the universe as it actually is. And the only way you do that is by asking the universe questions about itself.
Wow. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Ethan, thanks so much for joining us here today, expanding our minds, a theoretical astrophysicist in his prime right here. If you want to Google Ethan Siegel, you'll see a picture of a true astronomer, true scientist, and a rock and roll guy too, I think, maybe a little bit. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
It's time. It's Halloween time, as we've established. Again, can't wait. So it's time for a little fact or fiction. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
So the question is it true that there is going to be a full blood moon on Halloween for the very first time?
Well, so that is partially true and partially not true. The part that's partially true is that yes, we are going to have a full moon on Halloween, which is very exciting. This doesn't happen very often. It happens about once every 19 years. So last time we had this was in 2001, and about every 19 years, that's the cycle that repeats where you have full moon on a certain day of the year. But this is really exciting because, number one, Halloween is on a Saturday, which is also kind of rare, you know, 1 in 7 chance of that. You have a full moon, 1 in 19 chance, and it's going to be a blue moon.
A blue. But Blood Moon sounds so much more like...
I know. If only we could add the Blood Moon to it, too. If only there was an eclipse happening. So that's when you usually say Blood Moon, that's what we kind of usually go with, is that there's a lunar eclipse happening that night. But no lunar eclipse, but it will be a blue moon, which is by one definition when you have two full moons in one month. Mm-hmm. So we had a full moon early in October, and then we have a second full moon on the 31st. But for people that are really paying attention, if you're going to have a full moon on the 31st, by definition, it will always be a blue moon.
Oh, yeah. Because it
that's the only way you're going to have it, is right. The cycles. So every full moon on Halloween is always a blue moon. Not a blood moon in the sense that it's going to be an eclipse. However, if you want to get the blood moon effect, you can watch a moon rise. Whenever a moon rises up in the eastern sky, it'll look a little redder, just like a sunset. When it's setting, it turns red. So same with the moon. When the moon's low in the sky, it'll turn really red too. So while Grumpy. Not traditionally a blood moon, if you see it very low on the horizon, just as it comes up, it will look like the color of blood.
I can't wait.
I'm also
scared.
But it should be fun. It should be fun.
I can't wait. I'm more excited, though, less scared.
Yes. And then, of course, you have to deal with werewolves also when you have a full moon, too, on Halloween. So you got to watch out for werewolves.
Enough already, 2020.
I know. We've had enough of this.
That's it for this episode of Looking Up. We appreciate Dr. Ethan Siegel joining us. You'll find links to his writing on our website, wvxu.org/lookingup.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find us there. If that happens to be Apple Podcasts, your rating and comments will help others find us. So thanks for helping us out. And if you like what you hear, spread the word.
We'd love to hear your ideas for guests or topics. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or email us at lookingup@wvxu.org. Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.